Hello and welcome to the Opening Bell, the Boxing News podcast. My name is Matt Christie, the editor of Boxing News, and I'm alongside John Dennan. It's been a little while, hasn't it?
But we're back.
We're back. We've missed quite a few events while we've kind of been doing stuff in the print magazine, online, on social media, and there have been things going on.
Does that work as an excuse for why we've been off air for a month?
I think it works, mate. I think it works. I think the first thing to talk about, what we should talk about, because it's pressing, is the Frampton-Quigg match. But there are also things like Canelo Khan and Anthony Joshua against Charles Martin to talk about. But first of all, Frampton-Quigg, long time in the making. It's now days away. What are you feeling now? Are you really, really excited for this fight? And will you be buying it?
Yes, to all of the above. Especially as the closer it gets, the more I have no idea what's going to happen, but really looking forward to seeing it. I'm going to be watching it. Like, I'm not going to be working on it at the weekend, so I'm definitely. But I will be buying it as a fan, and I'll be able to just sit back and enjoy it.
There's a lot of people that are kind of, as I said in this week's column, you'll speak to someone about it. You know, however well educated they are in the boxing world, you'll speak to them. And 9 out of 10 people will turn and go, yeah, well, I always thought Quigg was going to win, or I always thought Frampton was going to win, but now I'm swaying. No one really knows what's going to happen, do they?
No. So I'm in the position where a while ago I'd sort of picked Frampton. I'm sure we asked this question in the magazine a long time ago, and I said I thought Frampton points. I feel, but as the fight gets closer, Quigg seems more and more confident, the less certain I am about what will happen, you know, method of victory, who the victor will be. In fact, the only people I've sort of spoken to who seem particularly convinced are people who are tipping Quigg.
Yeah.
And Quigg's been so confident in the build-up to this that's really surprised me. Maybe that's what's swaying a lot of people. Couple that with, you know, the way he performed against Kiko Martinez last time out.
There's been some interesting stuff where you can kind of monitor, or you can become kind of a psychologist and analyse their minds and their confidence levels. But as you say, Scott Quigg is there's certainly something that's quite frightening about him.
And yeah.
Without wishing to be disrespectful to him, you probably would say that Frampton is has probably got a higher IQ. He's probably a more intelligent person, you know, the general perception of intelligence. But for me, Quigg seems to be coming off the better when these two guys get together and do. Just because Quigg he's certain he's going to win. I'm not saying Frampton isn't, but there's something about Quigg that is certainly making me question my initial pick, which, like you, was Carl Frampton.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't think you're not saying that you think Carl Frampton is more intelligent. You're saying that's the way they sort of come across on camera, because I don't think.
No, I am saying that. That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying I think Carl Frampton is probably the more intelligent of the two.
Oh, right.
In terms of boxing intelligence, which is a term they keep banding around between them, boxing brain, which seems to have. Kind of go, no, I'm not talking about that. What I'm saying is that you would think that Frampton would come out better because he's the more articulate.
He's the more articulate
of the two. You would think that Frampton would come out better, or you would think that in those situations, Frampton would be able to manipulate them so that he comes across looking like he's going to be the favourite. However, everything that I've seen, Quigg looks like the favourite.
I think Frampton's more articulate and should come across better on camera. And Scott, he's actually much better talker. He's much better talker when you're just talking to him. But he's not, you know, it's harder in front of the camera, which is something I completely empathise with. If someone stuck a camera in my face, I suddenly find myself becoming bafflingly tongue-tied. But I thought it was a bit harsh when Carl in one of their head-to-heads was saying, you know, was talking about Scott's IQ, because, you know, being articulate isn't the same thing as being intelligent.
No, I take your point.
But, you know, it's a big question. Who's the cleverer fighter? Because I kind of thought, you know, with all Frampton's amateur experience, that he seems sort of more natural and adaptable in the ring. I don't know what to think anymore, but I certainly don't think, you know, to be as good as Scott Quigg is, you can't have a low boxing IQ, to use their term. Plus, you never know in this fight, it could be, you know, just executing the game plan could prove significant, and Scott Quigg certainly seems like he's got the, you know, all the ability to do that.
Do you think any of this is kind of unnerving Carl Frampton? As much as, I mean, we've online, we've got a lot of extensive interviews, there's some really good exclusive stuff in this week's print edition as well. And as you know, everybody, from the promoters to the trainers to the fighters, all kind of going, yes, you know what, this is just another fight, build-up's been exactly the same. Surely that's a load of nonsense, isn't it?
Sure, it's the most important
fight. That's an
absolute
load of nonsense. Frampton will, I think, suddenly really, really... I mean, they both will, perhaps, but Frampton more so, I think, or that's the impression I'm getting, will perhaps be feeling the pressure a little bit more because he's the favourite, slightly. A slight favourite.
Yeah. And there's that sort of... I think that Scott Quigg being so obsessional, I don't know, I'd find that unnerving. You know, maybe Carl Frampton doesn't, but it does, you know, I find it really disconcerting the way everyone's talking about how utterly dedicated he is in every way. But, you know, it's become a bit of a, you know, it's sort of, to pitch the fight as talent in Carl Frampton versus application dedication against Scott, you know, in Scott Quigg isn't exactly fair, because Carl Frampton's a very hard trainer and very dedicated. It's just that Scott Quigg seems completely obsessed.
Yeah, well, he does, doesn't he? I think the other thing, I mean, like, people have said that, you know, Frampton is the more natural fighter, and a lot of that is based around the fact that, you know, Frampton's got a more extensive amateur background. But I think you could say that Scott Quigg is a pretty natural fighter, given his lack of amateur experience and how good he is now, if you know what I mean. This was obviously his thing in life, boxing, because of how quickly he's picked it up and how far he's come in a comparatively short space of time. To me, this fight, it's... I don't recall one where I've been looking forward to it as much. I think I think there's two British fights recently, in recent years, where I can compare the anticipation and kind of that split where you're not really sure what's going to happen, and that would be Billy Joe Saunders against Chris Eubank, and Carl Froch, George Groves 2.
Yeah.
Both of those kind of had a similar, well, what the hell's going to happen kind of feel to it. However, I would put this higher than both of those in that they're both at their peaks. This is a unification world title fight. And it's been building for 5 years. Saunders Eubank kind of just happened in a way. Froch Groves too, again, wasn't building until the first fight was so competitive and controversial. Whereas this one has just been going on and on and on, and now we've got it. And unlike Pacquiao and Mayweather, for example, which was probably going on for a similar length of time, these two are getting in the ring when they appear to be at their physical peaks, whereas you can't say that for Mayweather and Pacquiao.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why is Carl Frampton the favourite?
To follow on from what you're saying about him being seen as the more natural, maybe you could argue that he is the more natural boxer because we've seen him fight going backwards off the fight on the back foot and going forwards as well, whereas I suppose Scott Quigg seems to be someone more who applies intelligent pressure and has that way of fighting. So I suppose that's why people think there are more dimensions to Carl Frampton as a boxer, and that's why he's the favourite.
There's also the whole, the trainers have kind of been drawn into this battle and...
drawn into it, they've jumped into it.
It's become almost, no, I mean, it's become a subplot in a very, very fascinating story.
Yeah.
Joe Gallagher will tell you, and he I'm sure he won't mind me saying that he frequently phones up Boxing News grumbling about, and he's been doing it for years, grumbling about the fact that we have got Frampton higher in the ratings. He will point to Quigg's achievements, and the two that he will point out the most are him hammering Rendell Munro and the fact that he has now beaten Kiko Martinez in two rounds. Has Joe Gallagher got a point in that Scott Quigg has been underrated for many years and perhaps deserves to be the favourite in this fight because of his past form? And also, and something else he'll talk about as well, is the stumble that Frampton had in the first round of his bout against Gonzalez Jr. in Texas. Should Quigg be the favourite?
You can make a strong case for him winning. Like, I genuinely think it's a 50-50 fight. And he does have a good track record. I suppose the argument for Frampton is he won a world title first. It was a more significant title because Guillermo Rigondo had the WBA super belt and Scott won the regular, or yeah, Scott got the regular belt, and then his first bout there was the draw with Salinas, the Cuban.
Yeah.
But then the counter argument that Scott performed much better against Kiko Martinez is a pretty strong one. It's just in Frampton's favour. You could say he got to Kiko Martinez first. How well Martinez performed against Leo Santa Cruz on the same night, again, is going to tell us a lot more about Quigg's performance against him. I don't know how much to read into the stumble against Alejandro Gonzalez on Frampton's part, because he got dropped, but he sort of dealt with it pretty well. Scott Quigg's touchdown earlier in his career, again, nothing major, and also that was held against him by sort of Team Frampton, sort of in an unfair way. He just got sort of caught off balance, but, you know, wasn't even hurt against Jamie Arthur. I think I was there for that fight in Bolton. It wasn't anything major. So yeah, I think you can make a very strong argument for both. Frampton hits very hard, but arguably Scott Quigg has even more power. You know, is that the thing that you could use to say that he's going to tip the fight in his favour?
I don't know.
I don't know anything anymore.
It's really interesting. I mean, that the fight against Gonzalez, both the Frampton Gonzalez fight, both camps will admit that. I mean, they'll both give you different reasons why, but they will both admit that that was a big, big turning point in negotiations. That allowed this fight to happen.
Yeah. And like Lee Selby went out to America and fought Montiel and didn't exactly dazzle against him.
No, but I think the difference there is that Montiel came with quite a lot of pedigree. He's, you know, former multi-weight world champion. Whereas Gonzalez, although, yeah, he comes from a good fighting stock. His dad was a world-class fighter back in the day. It was just no one was expecting Gonzalez to perform. And I think the fact that, you know, Shane McGuigan came out afterwards and said, you know what, Gonzalez, very, very underrated fighter, and, you know, he should be in the top five in the division.
Yeah.
And he's since lost.
Yeah.
But the official word there is that because I remember in the immediate aftermath there was talk of, well, Frampton, he was really struggling at the weight, and they've changed that now. They're now saying, well, no, that's not really the case. He did the weight in a completely different way because he was spending so long in such hot conditions. His weight was a lot lower and he thought he was fine, and he just did the weight completely differently. And as a consequence, it didn't suit him in the fight. That's the official word. You know, you can believe that or you don't. But you would say, though, from all these little rumblings, that perhaps that Quigg would seem to be the more comfortable at the weight, even though he looks physically bigger. Would that be fair to say?
I think so, certainly from that fight. And it's going to, normally weigh-ins aren't the most, necessarily the most exciting events in the world. This weigh-in is going to be really interesting because since that last fight, Joe Gallagher's been talking up, Carl Frampton's supposed struggles with making the weight. Is weighing in going to be a problem? It's certainly something to pay attention to. But it's weird because, I thought Scott Quigg seems to be the bigger man.
Or bigger, he looks bigger. Division.
Yeah. And so you kind of thought he'd be the one who should be sort of growing out of super bantamweight at some point soon. But we haven't seen any problems with Quigg making the weight before.
Quigg is, I think, one of the leading fighters in the country. Without question, his trainer is one of the best trainers in the country. Is he right, is Joe Gallagher right to be narked with Shane McGuigan? I think Joe's biggest problem is the fact that Shane McGuigan hasn't been on the scene for nearly as long as Joe Gallagher. Is Joe Gallagher right to be knocked, or is he taking this all a little bit too personally? Again, he'll say, look, it's not bothering me. This is all making me laugh. The fact is, if he's talking about it, chances are it is bothering him a little bit. Is he right to feel that Shane McGuigan is insulting him?
I think they've both been insulting each other quite publicly.
Can you understand why Joe's getting fed up with it?
Yeah. But people, well, hard to say. People, how people draw motivation. Like, it's almost, they're sort of, the underdog mentality maybe serves Joe Gallagher and Joe Gallagher's gym quite well because they're really successful. They've won so many bouts. They've won, they've got 3 world titles in the gym now. Yeah. But they have this feeling like they're not. The sense that they're not appreciated or they're underrated and they've got to go out and prove a point. Maybe that's part of being hungry and being motivated, and it seems to work for them. So, but how can you knock their achievements, especially as you can say that people from that gym have been overperforming and performing better than expected. Like, you wouldn't have been confident that Anthony Crawler was going to become a world champion, or that Liam Smith was going to become a world champion, and they have. But equally, Shane McGuigan hasn't had as big a stable as Joe Gallagher, but he has been with Carl Frampton for a long time and has done a good job with Carl Frampton. Would Carl Frampton have become a world champion with another trainer? Maybe, probably, but it would have to have been a good trainer, and can't prove a counterfactual. So McGuigan's done well. Joe has sort of said, you can't read anything into George Groves and David Hayes.
Sure,
because
they haven't
fought anyone decent yet.
Yeah.
But there must be a reason they've chosen him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Shane is a good trainer, really good trainer.
And it's just that he's very young.
Yeah, and it is, and dare I say it, I mean, someone younger than you can often you see it in all walks of life.
I know, when George Gigney came into the office. I hate that guy.
But you see it in all walks of life, all kind of different professions, and that can be an issue. I'm not saying that is the case, but it's certainly nothing new. Something as well is obviously Barry McGuigan is kind of a fucking national, he's a national treasure, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he has had faith, and I think he must be applauded with the faith and the way that he's guided Frampton's career.
Yeah.
But how much of a factor is Barry McGuigan in Carl Frampton's kind of reputation? Has he persuaded a lot of people to think that perhaps Carl Frampton is better than he is? Has he been able to secure opportunities for Cole Frampton that he wouldn't have got without Barry there, particularly in Ireland? And in terms of the fact that he also knew enough about himself to take a step back in negotiations in this fight, how much of a factor has Barry McGuigan been in this fight and in Frampton?
If something's coming from Barry McGuigan, that it carries a certain weight, so it's certainly helped Frampton become as big a name as he is. I mean, that's a ringing endorsement, you know, especially as Barry McGuigan's had such complete faith in him. But Frampton has had to do his part in the ring. You know, he won his world title in style, and other than the sort of hiccup in Texas, he has looked very good. You know, he looked devastating against Avalos, and you know, I think Barry McGuigan's helped build that kind of momentum behind him, but then having this huge, passionate crowd come out to support him in Belfast, they're so loud, that really creates an impression. So in that sense, it's smoothed the road for him. But Frampton still had to deliver in the ring, and it was, you know, probably the Barry McGuigan factor didn't make it an easy deal to bring this fight about. There were clearly certain things they weren't prepared to compromise on, but as time's gone on, there are others there are, and he probably has fought for and got a good deal for Frampton. But this fight is the sort of the acid test. I don't know what's going to happen.
No, I don't. I still don't know, and I'll probably change my mind a couple of times just while we've been having this conversation. And that's the beauty of it, though, isn't it? Yeah. I think that's the beauty of it, and that's when you just haven't really got an opinion on a fight. Well, not you haven't got an opinion, but you can't say with any degree of confidence who's going to win, then generally quite a good fight or something dramatic tends to follow. So I can't. I'm really lucky to be going. I'm heading up there on Friday. I'm just really excited. Really, really excited to see what happens. I'm going to be fascinated to see how the fight develops, how the winner goes about winning. And also, I think something else really, really interesting about this, or what will become really interesting, is how the loser copes with losing.
Yeah.
A fight of this magnitude, something that has been at the back of their mind for five years or more, maybe even more than the back of their mind, and for the last 4 months or so, it has just dominated their thoughts like nothing they've ever known, whether they care to admit it or not. It will be dominating their thoughts.
Yeah, and they must know. Maybe this is the fight they'll get remembered for.
Of course it is.
Winning this one.
Of course it is.
Or losing this one.
Of course it is. And I think also it's not just the fighters. We've spoke about the teams. Barry McGuigan. I mean, you sense Eddie Hearn will go over it one way or the other. quite quickly.
Yeah, he'll be absolutely fine.
But then you've got Joe Gallagher and Shane McGuigan, which again, they've put so much of themselves into it. They've put so much of themselves into their respective fighters' journeys as well, that it will be really, really interesting to see what happens during the fight and what happens afterwards. Just briefly, I mean, okay, it's no secret that a rematch is that both parties, although it's not, there was no rematch clause in any contracts, it's that both parties have kind of agreed to a rematch if one is necessary. But let's just say there isn't a rematch. What would be a good next step for the winner of Frampton Quigg?
I think Guillermo Rigondo is the obvious one. He's had his title stripped from him. He is the best in the division. You know, as he gets older, you know, he's only getting older. Maybe he's slowing down a touch. Maybe there are vulnerabilities. Just maybe he's a master boxer. But both Frampton and Quigg, whichever of them wins has the one punch power to, you know, to be a threat. I think that's the obvious fight to make. Will it? Well, it's the obvious fight in pure sporting terms, but Rigondo isn't bringing much in terms of TV backing, promotional backing, that kind of thing. And, you know, if that's the riskiest fight for the least reward, there, you know, the winner will have plenty of other options, whether that's Leo Santa Cruz moving up to featherweight, Lee Selby at featherweight.
You can certainly understand why Rigondo may not be next, can't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's I don't know. Let's see how they look on Saturday, but Rigondo, okay, he's not an overly exciting fighter, but I've always found him a pleasure to watch until his most recent fight, however, that I was ringside for, I didn't find that a pleasure to watch.
Yeah, and you wondered why he didn't push it.
Yeah, and particularly with everything that was going on beforehand, particularly given that he was given that platform so quickly after he'd been stripped of the titles, and he could have gone, well, okay, well, look at me, this is what I can do. And it was almost middle finger up kind of job. Or is he showing the signs of age? That kind of style does not go on forever and ever and ever. And he's 35, 36 years old now. I would say that whoever wins out of Frampton and Quigg, if they're going to go looking for the Rigondo fight, now would be the time to do it. Yeah. I'd give them both a really, really good shot at beating Rigondo. And the fight prior to that one as well, which I think was Christmas 2014, I can't remember the opponent's name, but he struggled in that one as well.
Yeah, where he got dropped.
He got dropped.
Yeah, and I think that suddenly, you know, sort of dented the aura he had about him. Like, it is possible to get to
exactly
it.
So we go back to what, 2013, when he beat Nonito Donaire, or was that 2014? I can't remember, but
it's, you know, 2013.
So we're going back a long time to when Rigondo earned his place in the mythical pound for pound ratings. He hasn't really looked that same fighter since. Maybe that's because he hasn't had the motivation, which is possible, and you can guarantee he'd be up for Carl Frampton or Scott Quigg. But all the evidence at the moment is suggesting that Rigondo could be slipping ever so slowly.
And if Jazza Dickens puts in a good show against him, suddenly it sort of, you know...
We haven't mentioned Jazza Dickens in all of this.
No.
We haven't, you know, in Jazza Dickens...
When he beats Rigondo, as a natural fight for the winner of Frampton Quigg.
Dickens is convinced in a similar kind of mode to Scott Quigg, he's convinced that he's going to win. He's going to beat Rigondo. That would be some story, though, wouldn't
it? That would be amazing. He's not a bad boxer, Jazza Dickens. He was.
No,
he was a good amateur, too.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's pretty unlikely.
It's unlikely, but you know, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with Rigondo over the next year or so.
But even the Frampton Quigg winner, you know, even like Nonito Donaire now has the WBO title, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think so. Barry McGuigan mentioned that Donaire would be among the fighters he'd rather see Frampton go after.
Yeah, you know, but that would be a higher profile. That would be a higher profile fight, even though Donaire lost to Rigondo.
Yeah, it would. It would, and that therein therein lies some of the complexities of the boxing world. Okay, so let's move on, because we've still got a few other things to talk about before we go. I don't think we've spoke about Canelo against Khan, have we?
We haven't.
I mean,
we've been off air for so long.
It seems like a long time ago where that bomb dropped and exploded all over press day, just as we was about to press the green button to send everything to the printers.
Yeah, it's awesome when massive news breaks half an hour before the magazine's supposed to go to press.
Yeah, it's always a laugh. But I mean, my initial reaction was, well, that's nonsense. That's not happening. When you kind of realise that it is happening, was that, well, surely Canelo is going to absolutely blaze through Amir Khan. Amir Khan is a good two divisions below. Only been at welterweight for, what, two or three fights. Canelo, the much bigger and stronger man, surely this is going to be over in two or three rounds. Then you start to think a little more deeply. You start to think about Amir Khan, his confidence, and his ability when he does assert himself, when he's concentrating, and his speed and you can see that this could be, this could be a competitive fight, and almost certainly there's going to be chunks of it which are exciting. Is that fair to say?
I think it's guaranteed to be exciting because Amir Khan always is, and actually, Canelo is as well. You know, if Canelo isn't great against fleet-footed opponents, Khan has really good hand speed, amazing hand speed, good work rate. Those are things, you know, you can imagine him buzzing around Canelo, making him look bad, causing him problems. But Canelo's, you know, an intelligent attacking fighter, and he's got heavy hands. So there is going to be this sense of doom hanging over Amir Khan
for as long as he lasts. Yeah.
Yeah, and like if he's been, you know, I thought he was all over Danny Garcia, but then he got knocked out. And if he got knocked out by Danny Garcia, Canelo's much bigger and stronger. And it's just even, because you see, even the weight of his punches was just pushing back Cotto.
Yeah.
You know, Cotto can deal with that. And he's.
So okay, John's. Microphone is just falling in a heap on the floor.
I don't know, am I back? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're all good.
Yeah, I was probably saying something.
So, the thing is with Amir Khan, and is that he, you know, he'll say that if he's fully focused, sometimes he switches off in fights. If he's fully focused, he can win this. And against Danny Garcia as well, he was in trouble, and you can't. There was a moment in that fight, I think it was in the fourth, when you just thought, or was it even in the third? When was it when he got? Anyway, there was a moment when you thought, right, he can ride this storm. But rather than trying to ride it, he gets right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
He gets right in the danger zone just to kind of. And I just feel, and I've felt it for a while now, is that no matter who's in the corner, no matter who is his trainer, no matter who's in the opposite corner, no matter what the game plan is, there comes a point in a fight, if there comes a point in a fight with Amir Khan where he feels like he needs to prove himself, he's going to do that.
Yeah.
It's nothing that's taught, it's nothing about game plans, it's something that's in there in Amir Khan. Perhaps with age, he'll be able to resist those urges to prove his machismo, and not get into a kind of a slugfest with Alvarez. But you sense that if he gets caught in the third round by Alvarez, he doesn't get knocked out, but he gets caught and he gets slightly wobbled. Everyone at ringside is going to be thinking, "Oh my God, he's about to lose."
Yeah.
Something will click in his head, going, "Do you know what? I'm just going to show him. I'm actually just going to show everyone here that." And he's got that about him, though, hasn't
he? Yeah, and it's hard to break out of those habits. Because you think he's gone to the right camp, as in with Virgil Hunter in his corner, being around, you know, someone like Andre Ward. Those are the right influences to have. But you just think he's too brave for his own good. And maybe even taking this fight is an example of that.
Let's flip it to the other side. We touched on the problems that, that Alvarez had with Floyd Mayweather. He had them with Austin Trout, Erislandy Lara, all different fighters in their own way to Amir Khan. But you can see that there could be a strategy that they can put in place to win this fight, Khan and his team. Is it completely inconceivable that Khan does remain focused for 12 rounds, and that after three or four rounds he's bewitched Alvarez, and his advantages, you would think, in speed could potentially take him through 12 rounds, and what we don't get is an exciting fight. We don't get an exciting fight. We get a boxing masterclass from Khan. Is that feasible?
I can see him boxing really well and doing much better than expected. But I can't see him winning it, because I just think he's going to have to stay away from Alvarez, and Alvarez is always going to have the weight and strength just to push him back and knock him out of exchanges. So yeah, he, you know, it's not you know, if he stays on it, if he boxes a game plan to perfection, you know, I can see him going the 12 rounds, but I do think Alvarez is going to win this one. I'd have him a heavy favourite. But then if Alvarez struggles against him, that's real, you know, he still loses a lot. Suddenly, you're not going to be thinking he has much of a chance against Gennady Golovkin, who's going to be expected to fight next. Whether he does fight next or not, I don't know.
Is this whole thing a masterstroke from Golden Boy in that they've brought in, you know, whether you love Khan or you hate him, he's one of the most marketable fighters in the world in terms of the fans that he'll bring over to Las Vegas. He's a much smaller man. If Alvarez, and this is perfectly feasible as well, just looks like an absolute monster and knocks Amir Khan out in one or two rounds, that's perfectly feasible.
Yeah.
While the whole world is watching, how much what does that do for his reputation? And surely Oscar De La Hoya, who, let's face it, Golden Boy, they haven't got that many jewels left, and the most valuable one most certainly is Alvarez. They're not going to throw him into any kind of fight pre-Golovkin that they think he's got any chance of losing. And De La Hoya, let's not forget, always spoke very, very highly of Khan, likes him as a fighter. So he's obviously absolutely convinced there's no chance that there's going to be an upset here.
Yeah. Yeah, but in that sense, it's smart, because this fight is going to be huge. We could see that for the reaction for when it was announced, partly because it was such a surprise. They managed, you know, normally they managed to keep it, they managed to keep their talk secret. There was no, you know, we spoke to Khan a lot in the sort of around whether he was going to fight Kell Brook, around whether he was going to fight Pacquiao, and he didn't breathe a word of Canelo.
No, we had him the week before as a guest columnist. Week before the guest columnist. We spoke to him literally a week before, literally 7 days before, while he was deep in negotiation with Golden Boy, and he did not say a word about it.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and Khan has called out everyone from Mayweather, Pacquiao, Danny Garcia, Brook, everyone, and didn't. And no one thought for a second he was actually going to fight Canelo. So that sort of surprise element around the fight itself makes it a must watch. It's going to be massive. And from Canelo's side, it's going to be as big a fight as they could have, in which they're going to be certain their man's going to win. They're going to be certain Canelo will win.
What is Las Vegas going to be like with a lot of Mexican supporters, a lot of British supporters in the lead up to Khan Canelo? It's going to be carnage, isn't it?
It's going to be pretty loud. And the fights in the new arena is sort of near the strip.
It's just over the MGM arena.
So it's going to be, you know, as big a gate as there's been in Las Vegas for a while. What, the biggest fight of the year, even though it could be one of the most one-sided fights of the year?
It's a strange one. It's difficult. I don't think it's difficult to make a case for Khan doing well, but it's certainly difficult to make a case for him winning the fight. Really, really difficult, I think. I think the more you toss it over in your mind, you just think at some point Khan is going to get, going to get caught. People have said it's kind of a, he's got nothing to lose, but there's also a danger that you know, and I don't want to kind of get too morose or whatever, but there's a danger that Khan could take quite a nasty beating in this fight, because he's a very, very, very courageous guy. If you were Virgil Hunter, if you were a member of Khan's team, would you have been quick to make this fight or recommend this fight to your fighter?
No. I suppose I'm quite cautious, but there is a lot of money to be made. You know, if he's making millions and millions, could he retire after this fight? You know, and if you've got huge confidence in him, you know, history has shown some boxers can step up way above their natural weight division and perform pretty well. And maybe they think, Khan's skill, and he is skilled, is gonna keep him safe. But it is a dangerous fight.
Has any of the romance in Khan's mission been lost because it's not really at middleweight? It's a pound over super welterweight or light middleweight. It's 155 pounds. Or is that really the only thing going for Khan?
Well, that's the thing that just makes this fight, you know, just means that you can contemplate this fight. I think, you know, it's right at the upper limit of what's realistically possible. You know, Golovkin is just too big. It would just be, I mean, this fight is pretty absurd. Fighting Golovkin would be insane. But yeah, it does make it. It's like a Charge of the Light Brigade type thing. He's kind of doomed, but you got to admire him for doing it.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what I saw something on social media. I can't remember which social media channel it was now, but I saw something of Khan kind of posing in the mirror, and he looks like he's already packed on more muscle than he's ever had as a boxer. And I just think it's going to be, you know, Khan saying, "Oh yeah, this is the way I should have been all along." We just kind of just think, "Well, no, otherwise you would have been a middleweight all along." But perhaps, and you do see it sometimes, that fighters will kind of bulk on, put on some muscle, put on a bit of extra weight, still look good, still retain their speed, and actually they are kind of a sterner unit than they were, particularly when they were deemed delicate a couple of weights below, for example. They do seem a bit of a sterner, stronger unit. There is a chance that could happen with Khan.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's more like traditionally in boxing, you're trying to boil down to as light as you could possibly be, but that's not good for you. You know, it doesn't make you durable. You know, and I think Khan has looked better. You know, like lightweight was too light for him and he was vulnerable there. He looked better when he moved up. And moving up to welterweight also looks like it's done him a world of good as well. So you could Khan going up to light middleweight would be sort of understandable, though maybe a bit on the big side. It's just that he's going slightly beyond that now.
I think if he'd been at welterweight for a number of years, I think that's kind of one of the things for me thinking that this jump is just going to be too much for him and too much for his body, is that he hadn't really got used to being a welterweight. He only had two, three fights there, I think.
Yeah. Well, I suppose he hasn't been that active.
No, it's
well,
true.
So he's been there for some time.
It's true. But no, we'll see. Another fight involving a British fighter going for a world title was announced. Not quite the kind of jaw dropping off your face and smashing into a million pieces shock that Khan Canelo produced, but Joshua against Charles Martin. What, all of a sudden?
Yeah, I'd say it was a bit of a shock, actually.
But we got word of it a week before that negotiations were advanced.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean. So when it was actually confirmed, it wasn't the biggest surprise in the world. To me, I think it's a no-brainer for Joshua. I think the biggest danger is that Charles Martin turns out to be something that we had no idea he was.
Which he could be, because we haven't seen much of him, because he hasn't fought anyone. You know, he only had a few rounds against Glasgow.
Yeah, he only had a few, and he looked okay, I thought, in that fight. He looked okay. But I don't go, I mean, there's some train of thought where people are saying that by accepting this fight, by moving up to fight for the IBF championship, he's putting himself into he's putting himself into a class that he won't be able to step back from. He's jumping up too far too soon. But I think that Joshua's people will deal with it very, very sensibly indeed. I think if he walks through Charles Martin on April 9th, I'm pretty sure you won't hear any of his team calling for Tyson Fury afterwards. I think it's going to be...
But doesn't this put him on a road that just...
It puts him on a road. It puts him on a road, but it doesn't put him at that destination. you put him on a road to that destination. And I think with the way the IBF rankings are stacked, that they can make that road quite long and quite scenic if they choose to. But I'd be astonished, even if Joshua walked out and smashed Charles Martin to pieces in 30 seconds, I'd be astonished if it was then, okay, Tyson Fury, let's bring it on. It wouldn't surprise me, however, if David Haye ends up turning up on that road before Tyson Fury does.
Yeah. But do you think David Haye and he could fight, do you think he might end up fighting David Haye and Tyson Fury next year in 2017?
Yeah, that would seem to be sensible, wouldn't it? That would seem to be sensible. But if you look at the IBF, even like Derek Chisora's in those rankings, there's fights like that that can be made.
Yeah.
There's still an elimination fight that's got to take place for the mandatory spot. And we know, I mean, the reason why Charles Martin has got this title is because of how stringent and how strict the IBF are with their mandatories.
Yeah.
But there isn't one in place at the moment, so Joshua can win this fight. I mean, we keep saying we'll go back to whether he will win it in a minute, but let's say Joshua does win this fight. He can pick and choose from the IBF rankings for a little while before he gets put under pressure to make a mandatory defence.
Erkan Tepe needs to be slung out of those races.
Well, he does really, and I think
slung out of boxing.
It's dreadful. I mean, what Erkan Tepe, the fact that it's still ongoing, and the fact that now they're having to go back and look. I mean, initially, I think that the story was that the A sample came back and it was positive. And if the Tepe team wanted to object or whatever, then they should then they needed to say, okay, well, look at the B sample. I think now they've said, okay, look at the B sample, which is what we're getting on for 9 months ago.
Yeah, what on earth are they waiting for?
It all has got a bad smell coming from it. Let's say that much.
Yeah.
So Tepe should be nowhere near those rankings. We shouldn't even be talking about him now anymore.
No.
To be honest, it's not like. I mean, when he's taking performance enhancing drugs acceptable, it never is, and I think we have to be. We're all in danger of going into a rant, but there has to be a zero policy.
Let it out, Matt.
But there has to be zero policy. If someone claims to have taken it by mistake.
Yeah.
But that is a completely different level to what Tepe was found with. He was found that there's a whole cocktail of the stuff.
Yeah.
Found at his home and in his body. It's insane. It's insane that he could possibly still fight for a world heavyweight title. And this is still going. He needs to be thrown out of the sport, pure and simple.
And for a long time. It can't be like a 6 month ban.
It needs to be. I think that the only way you're ever going to get around this, the only way, and even then, and that's presuming that people are not finding ways to beat the tests. But let's say that every test is reliable. Let's say that every fighter that takes drugs will get caught if they take a drug.
Yeah, let's say they even get tested enough.
Yeah, so let's say that happens. So that's got to happen, first of all. Then every single governing, sanctioning body must operate by the same rules. You get caught with something in your body, you'll get slung out for life, and that's it. That's the only way people are going to stop trying to beat the system. It's the only way, and I can't see a situation where that happens, because people, you know, people can't. It's all different rules in every country in boxing. Some of the states in America are dreadful, absolutely dreadful for what they're allowed to go on over there. So I just don't think you're going to see it. But anyway, going back to Tepe, who has been caught, kick him out.
Yeah.
Kick him out. Dreadful, dreadful. But anyway, back to Charles Martin.
I feel an editor's letter coming out here.
Back to Charles Martin. He's a bit of a unit himself. He's quite heavily. He's quite big. Okay, he's not as tall as Joshua.
But he's almost as tall,
and he almost looks almost naturally bigger, naturally bigger set in a way than Joshua. Not as muscular, but he's a unit. He's a big unit. He's not going to be. You feel that he won't feel physically intimidated by Joshua.
He might be psychologically intimidated by the crowd.
He might be psychologically intimidated, and I think that he's going to. I think he found the press conference. That may have been the fact that his senses were dulled by jet lag, but I think he found the press conference a bit of like, oh my goodness me.
Yeah.
But he had arrived the night before, and I think he was due to fly back that day.
He wasn't exactly on the spot, no, I think, conversational no. form.
So, but I think he will find it a bit of a shock when he walks into the O2 and he's got pretty much 18,000 people wanting Anthony Joshua to beat the hell out of him.
Yeah.
He'll find that a bit of a shock. But we all work in different ways. Some people, that might persuade them to go into a shell and fear for their life. For others, it forces them to come out fighting and absolutely thrive on it.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens with that. He's a southpaw as well, which, I mean, you know, and you can talk about how Joshua coped with him as an amateur, but he hasn't fought anyone as a professional who's southpaw. There's some factors there that Joshua's got to be wary of. This isn't all, okay, this is a mismatch, Joshua's going to win in one round, is it?
No.
We've got to give Charles Martin some respect, right?
Yeah, I think it's... I think there are a lot of unknowns about Charles Martin. We don't know how good he is, but that should be a worry. You know, whereas, like we say, if he was going in with someone like Derek Chisora, we've seen a lot of Derek, we know what he's capable, we'd have an idea of what type of fight it would be. Whereas Martin's an unknown, southpaws are dangerous. Joshua actually handled them well as an amateur, and he was really an inexperienced amateur, and he did well against the sort of top southpaws in world boxing then. But he hasn't fought many as a pro, so I don't think he would have been sparring many until now, and that is a factor. You need to sort of, you know, your habits need to become instinctively to you, and Martin will have an advantage in that department because he will have fought more orthodox professionals and sparred more orthodox professionals. But the indications from Josh's amateur career is that he should do well. You know, the weapon against the southpaw is a big straight right down the middle. We know Joshua's got that, you know, got a powerful one of those. So I definitely think Joshua will win, but it could be a really hard fight.
It could be.
Like, you've got to see, you know, just because of what he's done, because he's become a champion, you've got to see Martin as being, way above Dylan White in the pecking order. And Dylan White, even though Joshua ultimately won it well, it wasn't easy. You know, this could be tough.
No, but as I said in the column last week, if Dylan White was given a chance against Charles Martin, you'd give White a chance, wouldn't you?
I think after the Joshua fight, yes, but before he fought Joshua, you probably.
What I'm saying is that Martin may not be quite such a huge step up from White than people are saying. It could just be a step along.
yeah, I see what you mean. And I suppose when Martin won that title, he must have been viewed as one of the weakest heavyweight title holders.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I'd be surprised if this is where Joshua suffered his first defeat. But it's interesting, and I think that from a promotional point of view, it was a no-brainer. It looks really, really winnable for Joshua. Yeah. It looks really winnable.
I think the problem is, you know, then he'll be a world champion, and he's got to fight people deemed to be world class. I'm surprised they've gone for a world title so soon.
But he can fight. He can fight Jennings. He can fight Takam. He can fight Chisora. Those could be his next three fights. They could potentially have been his next three fights where he'd have fought Martin now anyway. So it's not like he's being plunged into this. You know, Takam, Chisora, Jennings, next three fights is different to if he'd been forced to fight Fury, Wilder, Hay, for example.
But I mean,
those kind of people, they're chasing other titles. Speaking of David Hay, I think that, you know, we haven't heard anything regarding his next opponent as yet. if you were David Haye and let's just say you wanted to earn as much money as possible in the shortest space of time, you would think that that would be securing a fight with Anthony Joshua.
Yeah.
Who should David Haye fight next if he's going to head that way towards getting that fight with Anthony Joshua sorted, say, within these next two fights?
I mean, shouldn't David Haye, if all you wanted was to fight Anthony Joshua, wouldn't you surely fight the easiest possible opposition, look devastating, but the easiest possible people you can find to keep yourself highly ranked, right?
Who would be, because they obviously, I mean, people are absolutely in outrage about Mark Demory as if, I mean, don't get me wrong, the fight was a farce. However, you can, from looking at it from David Haye's point of view, well, why not?
Yeah.
That to me, that doesn't shine a bad light on David Haye. That shines a horrendous light on the WBA, who had Demory ranked at number 10.
To shine on the WBA.
They had him at number 10, so why not? I mean, but that, I think there was, you know, David Haye said, well, yeah, I was saying that I put it out on Twitter, who should I fight next? And then Demory came to me and said, yeah, I'll fight you. Okay, maybe that's why the fight happened. However, I suspect the fight happened because they looked at the rankings. David Haye had been out for 3.5 years. Mark Demory was number 10 with the WBA. Hey presto, you get a number 10 ranking with a major governing body. Is there anyone else out there like Demory? We haven't got the ratings at hand. But I mean, what sort of fighter should, because he's going to have to go up a level, isn't he?
Yeah.
And Demory.
Yeah, but that still leaves him.
I mean, there was some
quite a long way to go.
Carlos Takam is fairly highly ranked, but you know, they've sparred. They've spent time sparring together. Haye speaks very highly of Takam. You almost feel that he wouldn't take that fight.
Yeah.
But that would be a fight that could lead him straight to Anthony Joshua. Could be Takam Joshua.
Yeah. Yeah, but then what if you want someone between Mark Demory and Takam? You know, someone like Steve Cunningham would have been a good name, former cruiserweight champion.
Yeah.
But he's got a fight booked in for April the 16th now.
Yeah.
If you want to make it fast, Shannon Briggs is your man.
He's ranked. He's highly ranked with someone. WBA again, I think.
There you go. Inevitably.
Yeah.
Yeah, people like that. I just can't see it being.
You don't think it's going to be. You don't think it's going to be a big challenge. You don't think we're going to be.
I can't see it being a competitive.
No, I agree. I agree.
You know, because the thing with Haye is, he's sort of been there and done it. He's got his proven track records, so he only needs to work his way up in the sense of getting someone who's going to get him ranked, and
but
could he just get a fight for an IBF intercontinental belt?
Will he not want someone to take him a few rounds? Will he not want that? Will that not be of benefit to him going into an Anthony Joshua fight, or will he go into the Anthony Joshua fight hell bent on knocking Anthony Joshua out in the first couple of rounds?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think to prepare himself best for the fight, having someone, you know, give him some competitive rounds in a bout would help him. But building it commercially, if you're just blasting people away, fans kind of love that.
Okay.
But, I mean, you know, I'm not saying I love that. I'm not saying I want David Haye to fight some random guy and just destroy him. But it's probably what's going to happen.
Okay.
But maybe I'm wrong. I've been wrong many times before.
We all have, mate. Don't worry too much about it. But no, it's really good. It's really good to catch up in the podcast arena. So we'll hopefully be back. Hopefully be back next week. I mean, there's been a few members of staff, not directly with Boxing News, but they've kind of been helping us out with the podcast and kind of. They're no longer here, so we've. That's also kind of a reason why we haven't done it.
Yeah, they're not dead.
No, they're not dead.
They've just moved on.
No, they have moved on. They've left NewsQuest. So, yeah, hopefully we'll be back to doing this every week. So thanks everybody for your patience. I hope you've all coped without us.
I haven't, mate.
But as always, your support on every level is greatly, greatly appreciated. Thanks very much for your time.